Welcome to the Space Show, Michael.
Thank you very much.
What's been your role in the New Horizons mission to Pluto?
Well, I started on this mission as just a test engineer, and the longer I stuck with the mission, the more job titles I accumulated. So I've been the RF communications lead, the REx experiment engineer, and currently I'm the payload system engineer, so I'm in charge of the safekeeping of the instruments.
Were you with the mission before the launch?
I was with the mission before the launch. I started with the mission about 3 years before launch.
So you sort of saw the birth of it, and did you go to the Cape to see it launch?
Yeah, I did. I brought my family down too. So we were down there with my mom and my dad, and we watched the launch. My kids weren't even born yet. So
usually when people wave something goodbye, they hope to see it again. But you were hoping you're not going to see it again.
No, the only way to see it again is in spectacular fashion, and you don't want to see it when you're on a launch pad.
Okay, so describe some of the challenges you faced on New Horizons.
Well, I would say that the hardest thing is actually all the work that has to be done for all the what-if scenarios. It's a one-time chance of getting it right, and there's you spend 9 years thinking of all the things that could possibly go wrong, and what would you do if this one went wrong? What would you do if that one went wrong? You know, and so working with every single team and trying to figure out everything that could possibly go wrong, and then ranking those about which ones are likely and which ones are unlikely, and then having to decide exactly how you would handle that if it happened in short notice.
And did anything go wrong?
Yes, actually. On the 4th of July, we overtaxed the space computer, the CNDH, Command and Data Handling Computer. We had just loaded the sequence of commands that was going to execute for the next 10 days, and at the same time, we issued the commands to compress all the data that was already on the recorder into a new segment to clear up space, because we were going to fill it. But those two things can't happen at the same time, and so the computer basically raised its hand and said, "You can't do that to me," and I quit. And so the spacecraft went safe, and it switched to the backup computer. And this was just a couple days before we were planning on entering that really critical period of time. And so we stayed up for about 3 days straight fixing the problem, and we knew exactly what we did when we did it. You know, and it was kind of... Yeah, so the team knew what had to happen. It's just a matter of trying to get all the steps in place, and it takes 9 hours at Pluto for light to get there and back. So it takes a long time. Anytime you're going to update anything, it takes 9 hours to tell whether or not it actually worked. So we finished it, fixed it all, and we had about 3 hours to spare.
I remember when that happened in 2015, and I screamed, "Oh no, not after all this time."
Yeah, well, us too. We actually, it's funny because it's called a bus controller swap, a bus controller to remote terminal swap when one computer decides it's not going to be the one in charge anymore. And we had talked about rehearsing that at some point during the mission, but we decided that it was going to be too risky. And then the fates decided to conspire against us and say that we were going to do it anyways.
Yes, quite often in a space mission, you've tested everything you can think of, but it's something else comes up and bites you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
You were involved in a rather interesting thing called a radio occultation measurements, and you involved our Australian tracking stations in that. So, first of all, what is a radio occultation, and what measurements were you making?
So an occultation in general is you're watching a source of light of one kind or another, get winked out as you go behind the target. So there are occultations where you can look at, this is how they find exoplanets around other stars, is you're looking at a star and you're watching the light go away and come back. The difference between the radio occultation where we use the Australian stations is instead of it just being visible light like that, it's X-band radio waves. So they were transmitting about 8 gigahertz up to our spacecraft, and as that goes through the atmosphere, depending on the properties of the atmosphere, you'll get, you know, some winking, some weird wiggles in the signal as it goes away. If there's an atmosphere. If there's not an atmosphere, it just kind of drops solid out.
You just get the diffraction grating sort of effect, up and down and fading away.
That's exactly right, yeah. So
with that, then you can tell whether it has an atmosphere and certain things about the atmosphere.
Yeah, that's right. So it's actually it's a two instrument problem. So the ALICE instrument did a stellar a solar occultation at the same time. So with the sun coming through, it was able to determine it with ultraviolet light what the upper atmosphere was made of, and then at UV light doesn't penetrate very far into anything. But the X-band radio signal does. So when the UV light cuts out, the X-band signal is still doing its job there. So we get the last few hundred meters of atmosphere, and we can measure the pressure and temperature of the atmosphere at the surface.
I remember years and years ago when people were advocating a Pluto to mission, they were worried that if we left it too long, there wouldn't be any atmosphere left because Pluto has gone through its perihelion, closest point to the sun, in fact, closer than Neptune, and is now moving away, and that if they left it too long, all the atmosphere would freeze out. Has that been happening?
So it actually turns out that they think that it's the cycles are actually more frequent than just the orbit of the planet now. So it's not as simple a problem as we originally thought. But there are all kinds of features on the planet that show that it had to have a denser atmosphere than people were expecting at various times. And because we see surface features on the target that nobody expected because they expected it to be a dead world. You know, there was no internal heat, at the edge of the solar system. It's been there forever, for 4 billion years. But we still see brand new, fresh surfaces that it's turning itself over. So it's just another one of the unexpected behaviors. But we are at about a minimum of atmospheric pressure. But there are things on Pluto, like frozen lakes, that those can't form under low atmospheric pressure like this. So it's indications that there was much higher atmospheric pressure in the past.
And, of course, Pluto lying, well, pretty much on its side, means that as it goes around its orbit around the sun, there's a hemisphere that's in dark for a while, and then on the other side of the sun, it's the opposite hemisphere. So that must drive gases and things from one hemisphere to the other.
Yeah, I believe that's the case. So I'm not a scientist on this mission, but all I get is through osmosis when I get to sit in the room and listen to these people make these discoveries.
And that could only be made in the few minutes after you flew by the planet. Oh, I'll call it a planet still, a dwarf planet.
The occultation, yes. So it's the whole mission design was designed to cross through the shadows of both Pluto and Charon. So it was the timing of everything was to make sure that Canberra stations at the DSN and actually the Goldstone stations in California as a backup, so that if we had two different ground stations that could be transmitting at any one time. And that Pluto was in the sky at the right time, and that the spacecraft was actually flying through the shadows of both those targets. So that was a complicated dance that you have to make sure that all those things are happening in concert.
Which way was the radio science working? Was it New Horizons picking up the signal from the Earth, from Canberra, Tidbinbilla, and from Goldstone? Or was it Goldstone and Tidbinbilla picking up the signal from New Horizons? Or was it both?
So in this case, New Horizons is unique in that usually an occultation experiment like this is a downlink experiment. So it's usually the spacecraft. So at Mars, they did it with the spacecraft transmitting to the ground and using a radio science receiver on the ground. We flipped the problem on its head because we needed the 20 kilowatts and 10 million times gain of these 70 meter antennas in order to get out to 30 AU. And so we actually put the radio science receiver on board the spacecraft, and that's what we call the REX instrument. So it's an uplink measurement that we made.
What else did we find out in your area on this mission?
The other things that we accomplished with the REX instrument is that we actually accomplished a bistatic radar. So we actually did a radar measurement at 30 AU. So transmitting from Earth, we bounced a signal off the planet and back into the spacecraft. And with that, you can figure out what the dielectric constant of the planet is, or at least that part of the surface. It's a very diverse surface. So, depending on exactly where that was, it could be very different on the other side. But we also, for the we, it, there was some question. We didn't even know what the true size of Pluto was. So, I mean, even the basics about what its diameter and that kind of thing are were things that we nailed down, because there was a question of whether or not it's even the biggest in the Kuiper Belt. And as far as we know now, it is bigger than Eros and the other objects out there. So it is the biggest.
Yeah, that you mentioned the biostatic radar signal. Did you get one off Charon as well as Pluto?
No, we didn't do a biostatic on Charon. The distances weren't fortuitous for that. And this was not a prime objective to try to get this biostatic radar. And so we managed to kind of shoehorn it in to another REX measurement called a thermoscan. So we were taking a temperature profile as the REX instrument was looking across the planet. But at that point, if you imagine Pluto being a disco ball, that point of light where Earth would have perfectly reflected in it, that's where you see the radar. And then the rest of the measurement of the scan across Pluto was to get a temperature profile across that area. So we did a temperature profile across the equatorial region and then another over the pole.
So a 9-year flight out to Pluto and just a few minutes to gather your data.
Yeah, well, you know, we actually started our encounter almost a year ahead of time. You know, we woke up about a year before encounter, but all the closest approach things all happened there in those last 48 hours. So all the images that you see in the press clippings are from the 48 hours, but we were busy during doing what we considered encounter operations all the way there. So, you know, it's just maybe 40 days out before closest approach is when the Pluto was resolved better than Hubble could do, and so we started seeing new information then. But we had to wake up, we had to get there, we had to do trajectory control burns of the main engine in order to target exactly when we wanted to be there and where we wanted to go, and all that activity started a year in advance.
New Horizons, you're now halfway towards a Kuiper Belt object called 2014 MU69. Are you going to do any radio science there?
Yeah, we're actually going to be doing a biostatic there, too. So the Pluto one was the furthest out anybody's ever done a radar, and we're going to see if we can break our own record there. Also, in the Pluto-Charon system, because Pluto has so many satellites, you can actually determine the mass of Pluto by its interrelationships with these other satellites. So for MU69, we don't know if it has satellites. And so we need to see if there's another way that we can get the mass. And one way to do that is by measuring the Doppler shift as you go past the target. So we're going to use the same instrument to monitor the uplink from Canberra, again, from the Australian DSN stations, and watch the tiny bit of pull that the object will have on us as we go through its little bit of gravity. And if we can measure that, we can get a mass on the target.
Well, Michael, what's been your career path that led you to this role?
So I've been involved with, I had some undergraduate internships in the space area. I worked for a company called the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics briefly. But really, for me, as my dad always said, no amount of careful planning can substitute for dumb luck. And I think that I got lucky here. So what actually led me to this project is that my wife, my now wife and girlfriend at the time, worked at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab in Baltimore, Maryland, or in Laurel, Maryland. And I knew that I was going to chase her out because I was finishing up my degree in Colorado, and I knew that I wanted to be with her. So I followed her out to the East Coast of the United States. And the only day that I could interview was a day right after a holiday, and the only people working were the people that had to be at work because the celestial mechanics gods don't pay attention to our holidays. So the people that were working there were in the space department, and I got interviewed by a few different groups there, and I was lucky enough to get a job offer.
And what's next? Are you going to continue with the New Horizons team as you head out towards this Kuiper Belt object 2014 MU69?
I absolutely am. You know, New Horizons is a special thing for me. It's the first thing that I ever worked on, and actually also has the possibility, depending on if we can get extended missions funded and things like that, it could be the very last thing I work on too. So it could be my entire career, from start to finish, could be working on New Horizons. So I want to be there when we turn out the lights.
I hear that so often. The first one you work on is your favorite.
Yeah, that, I guess that's not surprising, but it is my favorite. It's absolutely been a dream to work on.
And Michael, what brings you here to Australia?
Well, we really just wanted to come down and make sure that the people down in at the Deep Space Network recognized how important their role was to making this mission a success. New Horizons is over the southern sky, and so the stations here in Australia are extremely useful to us. We get longer times when New Horizons is in the sky. We can get higher data rates through them than any other station. And so, you know, it took us more than a year to get all that data back afterwards. And it would have been even longer if we didn't have these Australian stations. And so sometimes the people that are on the console driving the antennas are the last to find out about things, and we didn't want them to be missing out, and we wanted to say thank you.
Well, thank you for coming here to Melbourne.
Well, thank you very much.